Sarah Helmer is a specialist in clinical pharmacology and aged care at the Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney. She's also associate professor at Sydney Medical School, University of Sydney. Now, people over 65 years of age take more medications than any other age group. Older people have more to gain from medication, which may delay or cure disease or manage symptoms. They also have more to lose from adverse events associated with drugs. Around half of those over 65 use five or more drugs. In this podcast, we will discuss the evidence for medications commonly used in primary care among older patients. Professor Helmer, can you tell us why medication use among the elderly needs to be re-examined? Hasn't the safety and benefit of medication already been established?
Well, Sophia, ironically, despite the fact that older people have the most disease and use the most drugs, most of the evidence we have on the safety and effectiveness of these drugs actually comes from studies in younger adults. In fact, the nature of clinical trials is such that even if older adults are included, they tend to be the robust old, people who don't have comorbidities or co-medications or functional impairments. So actually, we know very little about the safety or effectiveness of drugs in the very old or frail older people. There are some key issues that you need to think about when you're evaluating a drug in older people. Firstly, the effects of those medicines in the context of the person's other illnesses or their other medications. Secondly, you need to think about the outcomes of trials. A lot of trials look at disease outcomes. And for an older person, often a functional outcome will be what's really important. Is this medication going to help me stay in my own home? Is this going to keep me physically and mentally active and well? And those things are really very rarely assessed in clinical trials. So we really don't know if medications work in older people, and particularly frail older people with a lot of problems. We don't know if medications work to affect the outcomes that are really important for older people. And what we do have is a growing body of evidence of the risks of medicines in older people. And most of this comes from observational studies, which are a good way to assess risk. Mm-hmm. And there's a growing body of evidence that older people are very susceptible to adverse drug reactions, which may present as something very obvious, like a bleed from aspirin or warfarin, but may present more subtly with impairment of physical function or confusion.
Mm-hmm. Now, Professor Helmer, you raised you touched on the difference between robust and frail older adults. Could you tell us a little bit more about these differences and why you believe that this difference is actually clinically useful?
Yes, well, Sophia, there's a big difference between one 80-year-old and another. When we're young, you can look at a group of babies who are 6 months old and they've all achieved roughly the same milestones and can do about the same things. But that inter-individual variation increases radically when you're in your 80s and 90s, and you'll have some 80-year-olds who are what we call robust, who are very mobile, functionally independent, often still running in the city to surf, and then you'll have other 80-year-olds who are what we call frail, who are often very functionally dependent, maybe living in residential aged care. And these people are clearly very different to each other. And recently there have been efforts to actually try to define this in an objective way. And there are a number of measures of frailty that are available now that you can use both in research and in clinical practice. And there are two main ones. One is what we call a frailty phenotype, which looks at whether you have unintentional weight loss, a feeling of exhaustion, weakness, and slowness in walking and low physical activity. And the other looks at an accumulation of the total number of problems you may have across the medical, social, and functional spheres. And both of those measures have been applied in studies of older people and have shown that there are sort of biological as well as medical implications of frailty. And so how can we use this clinically? Well, I think in prescribing drugs, you want to think firstly in terms of therapeutic goals. And clearly your therapeutic goals for a robust person who is really aiming to stay well and alive as long as possible are going to be quite different to those for a frail person. For a robust person, you want to keep them well, you want to prevent disease, and you want to maintain functional independence, and you ideally want to prolong life. For a frail older person, you really want to minimize further functional decline and aim for symptomatic control. And so, yeah, one area that's clinically important is in looking at therapeutic aims. The next thing that's clinically important is differences you might see in pharmacokinetics, how the person handles the drug. And there's a growing body of evidence that people who are frail don't metabolize their drugs or clear their drugs as well as people who are robust. So you need to think about dose adjustments for people who are frail if you are going to use a medicine. There are also differences in pharmacodynamics, so the effects of the drug on the body. So people who are frail have are more susceptible to adverse drug events and often will be more susceptible to the effects of drugs. For example, the effects of metoclopramide on sedation are much greater in people who are frail than people who are not frail, even for people with the same blood level of the metoclopramide. So it's important to think about frailty in terms of therapeutic aims, pharmacokinetics, sort of what dose to use, pharmacodynamics, what effects to expect. And also, as I mentioned before, it's important in terms of the evidence base. If you're trying to work out if there is evidence to support your therapy, for the robust older person, you may have some evidence. There will be some older, robust people in clinical trials who you can use to inform your decision-making. For the frail older person, you're usually extrapolating from those few robust people in the clinical trials.
Professor Hilmer, we in general practice often talk about our desire to have a patient-focused approach, and certainly what you've explained about the differences between robust and frail older people sounds like one way in which we might have a patient-focused approach when it comes to prescribing for our older patients. Now, in the article, it examines the evidence for benefits and harms of some commonly used drugs in general practice. I'd like to highlight two of these. Firstly, antihypertensives. Can you take us through what the evidence is here?
Look, antihypertensives have been evaluated in a lot of older people who are predominantly robust older people. And there's very good evidence on a lot of meta-analyses that if you look at antihypertensives for secondary prevention of all-cause mortality, that they do reduce your risk of dying with a relative risk of about 0.9, which basically means that if you receive an antihypertensive, then compared to people who don't receive it, you've got about a 0.9% of dying. We like to look at clinical trials in terms of numbers needed to treat and numbers needed to harm. And these numbers, I think, are really quite useful for general practitioners because they can put relative risks into the context of your practice. So the number needed to treat is the number of patients you need to treat for the stated time period for one patient to experience a stated benefit. So if you treat 84 patients for secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease over 4.5 years, then you'll prevent one death. And on the other hand, we look at numbers needed to harm, which is basically the number of patients who need to be treated for the stated time period for one patient to experience the stated adverse event. And with antihypertensives, you actually only need to treat two patients to experience any adverse event over 4.5 years. So as a general practitioner, you'll probably find that you can detect the adverse events very easily because every second patient will report one. But to detect that one in 84 deaths that you prevented will be much more difficult. There have also been subgroup analyses of these trials that look at preventing mortality, that look at just the patients who were in the clinical trials who were over 80. So these are predominantly robust older people who can participate in these involved clinical trials. And don't have all the exclusion criteria. And interestingly, even amongst the robust older people, you don't actually get a mortality benefit from treatment with antihypertensives. And the other interesting arm of evidence, which is actually quite strong, is the evidence for withdrawing antihypertensives in older people. And there have actually been a number of antihypertensive withdrawal trials, many of which are actually in general practice in Australia. And overall, between 20 and 85% of participants have remained normotensive 6 months to 5 years after stopping antihypertensives with no increase in mortality. So if you're thinking about a medicine that you could potentially stop safely, antihypertensives are a good one to think about. And the nice thing about antihypertensives is it's very easy to monitor whether you're actually getting rebound hypertension or not. And generally, you can do it quite safely.
Well, that's very interesting. The second thing I wanted to touch on is statins. They're commonly prescribed as well.
They are, and almost half of older Australians are taking statins. And in older patients, the best evidence we have for statins is for secondary prevention of cardiovascular events and death in patients with coronary heart disease. And if you think about this in terms of numbers needed to treat, you would need to treat 28 patients aged over 65 for 5 years to prevent one death. So that's a number needed to treat of 28. And that's in the context of secondary prevention. And if you look at this in a pharmacoeconomic sense, we talk about the cost per quality associated life year, or a QALY. So if we think about this in terms of cost per quality associated life year, or QALY, for secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease, the cost of a statin is between $15,000 and $24,000, and that's true for people aged 45 to 85. Interestingly, if you look at using statins for primary prevention of coronary heart disease, the cost per QALY increases with age from about $26,000 to $90,000 at 65 years to between $56,000 and $169,000 at 85 years. And so you could argue that statins are cost-effective if you're using them for secondary prevention, but less so for primary prevention, particularly in the very old. It's also interesting to think about numbers needed to harm for statins. And you would need to treat 10 to 20 patients for one to experience a myalgia. So, and that myalgia could range from a mild muscle ache through to a severe myositis or rhabdomyolysis. So again, the general practitioner will probably see the harm, and it will be more difficult to detect the potential benefit. Statins are another drug which general practitioners can really think about withdrawing. And you start thinking about withdrawing statins when the potential benefits are really no longer clinically relevant. So in patients who have very severe physical or cognitive impairments, or those in their last year of life, reducing the risk of vascular events or mortality may not be an important therapeutic aim. You might also reduce statins if frail older patients have significant symptoms or signs that might be adverse events from statins. And some of these are quite vague, things like muscle ache or muscle weakness or cognitive impairment, and they can be symptoms of statins or they can be something else. But if there's a temporal pattern that suggests it might be statin use, then it's very reasonable to at least try withdrawing the statin and see what happens.
The article, especially Table 1, compares the benefits and harms for older adults of other common drugs such as aspirin, antiplatelets, warfarin and bisphosphonates. Now, Professor Hilmer, some people might look at the material you've presented in the article and raise an ethical objection. Is it ethical to look at medication withdrawal in a certain section of our population? How would you address this important concern?
I think it's very ethical to think about medication withdrawal, and we can just follow the basic pillars of ethics when we're thinking about this. We think about beneficence, or the duty to be good, non-maleficence, or avoiding harm, patient autonomy, and the principle of justice. And we can think about these in terms of individuals and in terms of the population, and they apply very well to withdrawing medicines as well as prescribing medicines. So if you're thinking about beneficence, that's the effectiveness of medicines. And only a very small proportion of medicines can really be monitored clinically in individual patients. things like analgesics can tell whether they work or not. Other medicines like the ones we discussed, like antihypertensives and statins, are really very difficult for the general practitioner to actually tell if they're helping the individual or not. And other things, yeah, we're really limited by surrogate markers. So instead, you rely entirely on the likelihood of doing good, which comes from the results of clinical trials that actually may not be generalizable to frail older people. The trials probably didn't include frail older people and didn't include outcomes that are relevant to frail older people. So if you're thinking about beneficence, often you have very limited evidence of beneficence, and so you're not really not sure whether you're doing good by prescribing a medicine or not. On the other hand, you've got to think about the principle of non-maleficence, or avoiding harm. And adverse drug reactions are a very good example of avoidable harm. We know they increase as you get older and as you become more frail. And we also know they can be quite difficult to detect. They can present very atypically as geriatric syndromes like falls and confusion, incontinence, functional impairment. We've got quite good evidence that there's increased harm from polypharmacy. We know that five or more drugs increases your chance of falling over, of becoming frail, of hospitalisation, institutionalisation and death. And we also know about harm from what we call the prescribing cascade, where you prescribe one drug to treat the side effects of others. And so if we think about stopping medicines in terms of non-maleficence, I think if we suspect an adverse drug reaction might be causing an older person harm, then it's very ethical to stop the medicine. Next principle is autonomy, and it can be quite difficult to show respect for autonomy when a patient's not competent to consent to treatment because of cognitive impairment. We often fall upon talking to carers who often act as surrogate decision makers. And this can be quite difficult. It's important to try to tease out from the carer what the patient would have wanted as opposed to what they may want themselves, because carers can be in a very conflicted position. If you think about things like the treatment of behavioural disturbances in dementia, the patient takes all the risk of the adverse events, and the person who has something to gain is generally the carer, and that puts the carer in a very difficult position. Sometimes it's helpful when you're trying to think about patient autonomy and discuss this with a competent patient or with their carer to talk in terms of numbers needed to treat and numbers needed to harm, so that patients can weigh up the risks and benefits and prioritise things in terms of their personal priorities. There's been some very interesting work done in the US where people have spoken about numbers needed to treat for antihypertensives to prevent one stroke or to cause one fall, and that gives patients and their carers a good way to actually weigh up their own personal priorities and maintain some autonomy in decision making. The final principle I want to talk about is a principle of justice, which is about fair, unbiased treatment on the basis of medical need. And in Australia, we're really a very just society. We don't have any age-based economic rationing of medicines on a population level. However, there are some individuals and communities of older patients who are on multiple medications who may not be able to afford them despite government subsidies. And again, in those situations, particularly when we weigh up the principles of whether there's any benefit, whether there's any harm, what the patient actually wants, spending our money on medicines may not be the best thing for the patient. So using those four pillars of beneficence, non-maleficence, autonomy and justice are actually very useful in guiding our therapy for older people, particularly for frail older people where there's not a lot of evidence base or guideline to really help us on our way.
Well, that was a very thorough discussion of those principles there. Professor Helmer, you mentioned earlier that some of the trials in withdrawing medication had been conducted in the Australian general practice setting, and you also suggested that optimising medication can be performed safely in general practice. Now, optimising medication is an important process. It would require multidisciplinary input together with patient and family involvement. What management steps would you suggest to GPs?
Optimising medication is one of the most important things a GP does for an older person and can really make a big difference to their function. I think GPs are in an ideal position to optimise patients' medicines because it really requires coordination of the patient, their caregivers, and all of the other health professionals involved in their care. And the GP is the one who is in communication with all these people and in a good position to negotiate changes. I will say that it is time-consuming to optimise a person's medicines, and it's good to use as many of the other services around as you possibly can to help you, particularly things like the accredited pharmacists doing home medicines reviews and residential medication management reviews. So I've outlined 8 key steps in Figure 1 of the article that I think allow us or facilitate optimising medication use. And I won't go through them now, but I will say that the most important ones are getting a really complete patient assessment in terms of their medical and functional history, as well as their frailty, life expectancy, and likely trajectory of decline, and then working out the therapeutic goals with the patient and their carer, and working out goals that are realistic and achievable and consistent with the patient's assessment, but also things that fit the patient's priorities. And those goals can range right through from symptom relief to preventative medicine. And I won't take you through the rest of the figure, but I would refer your readers to Figure 1 in the article.
Thank you. Now, you say that, and we agree, goal-directed prescribing is important for our older patients. How often are you suggesting that GPs take their older patients through this optimising medication process through these 8 steps?
Look, it really depends very much on the patient. So I think it's important to do it when the patient's condition changes. So patients will transition often quite quickly from being quite robust to being quite frail, and when you notice that, it's a good time to take them through the 8 steps. Also, when patients have a new diagnosis, that will impact on all their other medical and functional issues. It's a good time to review their medicines. When patients have had admission to hospital or when patients are admitted to residential aged care, those are all good times to review a person's medicines and can be a good prompt. It's really important that patients and their families are reassured that medicines are being changed so that they can achieve their therapeutic goals. And if you do decide to stop drugs, it must be clear that this is because they're causing harm or not of benefit, not because the patient's not worth treating. And if you make it very clear that stopping drugs is actually a therapeutic intervention and you're monitoring the patient closely and talking with the patient throughout the period of medication change, making sure their goals are being met, that the patient will be much more satisfied with the intervention than if it just happens without any of that discussion.
Thank you, Professor Helmer. For more information, you can refer to the December 2012 Focus article, Thinking Through the Medication List, led by Professor Helmer.